I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For decades, security at America's borders and around the world has been at the top of Washington's list of concerns. And the Trump administration has made bold changes to longstanding U.S. national and homeland security policy. Not everyone agrees those changes are a good thing. Today, a conversation with former Ambassador Thomas Pickering. He worries that the president's approach in the Middle East and elsewhere will not generate a desirable outcome. Then another perspective, former Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano says there are some political blind spots putting our country's safety at risk. We ask her to point them out. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. American foreign policy in the Middle East has always been a balancing act, shifting alliances, economic incentives and sanctions, the looming threat of nuclear weapons, and a deep but sometimes contentious friendship with Israel. Perhaps no country's history with the U.S. is more fraught in the region than that of Iran, and in the presidency of Donald Trump, perhaps no relationship has seen more turbulence. Thomas Pickering is a career diplomat serving in high-ranking roles in the administrations of both parties for decades. He was ambassador to the United Nations during George H.W. Bush's presidency. He's also been undersecretary of state in the Clinton administration and ambassador to Russia and Israel and Jordan and India and Nigeria. He's here with us today to talk about the Middle East, especially Iran, and how America can help or hurt the cause of peace and security there. Ambassador Pickering, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Brian.
It's really great to have you here. And we should mention that Ambassador Pickering's in town to speak at the International Relations Council tonight. You can find out more at irckc.org. You're talking tonight first and foremost about Iran. You've written recently that for all the attention the current administration's giving Iran, the effect is going to be to push the country into the arms of its enemies. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, in effect, our decision to withdraw from the treaty, the nuclear treaty, has meant that Russia and China have continued the treaty with Iran and are now in a unique opportunity to befriend Iran. And our withdrawal from the treaty has meant that we are sanctioning our European friends and allies to get them to do the same thing, and they aren't. And so that is helping the Russians drive wedges between us and the Europeans.
So we're getting an assist in that effort from the Russians, that effort to drive Iran into the arms of our enemies.
A lot of spin on a negative ball.
Take us back a little bit. In your judgment, the economic sanctions, the pieces that were in place prior to the Trump administration, were those working?
They were working. They worked not only to get the Iranians to the table, but to prepare an agreement that was, from all of us who had followed it closely, well beyond expectations. And the United States never withdrew its direct sanctions against Iran. We did withdraw our secondary sanctions against the Europeans using U.S. dollars and trading with Iran.
So then what changed, or did anything change that caused the current administration, in your view, to have a good reason to rethink that regime of sanctions?
Brian, I think that this was unfortunately an exercise in domestic politics. I find it hard to know that there was any useful purpose served by withdrawing from the treaty. And in withdrawing, we violated a treaty which has not been the U.S. habit. People have said, well, ballistic missiles should have been included in the deal. They were not, for very good reason, because we would have lost our capacity to limit strictly and inspect strongly the Iran nuclear program if we had to pay in a coin of nuclear restrictions for the ballistic missile restraints. And we could do the ballistic missile restraints anytime, anywhere, to follow on the nuclear question. And ballistic missiles are a danger, but with nuclear weapons, they are a much bigger danger. Without, they are much less.
So what happens now with that treaty and with the possibility of nuclear arms in Iran? There were other countries that were party to this agreement.
There are, and they're keeping the agreement, and it remains in force, and it's our good luck, despite the fact that our policy is designed to disrupt and to damage that. The president has said he wants a better agreement, but he's put nothing on the table for all this time. I think a better agreement could have been confected, but you didn't need to destroy the agreement that held the Iranians in check on a nuclear weapons program to get a better agreement. And now, of course, better agreement. We have no allies to support us, and as a result, no general sanctions to force that agreement.
Which I guess raises the question, in your judgment, what the impact of this sort of decision on the part of American foreign policymakers is on America's ability to lead in other areas, to have standing when it comes to its relationships with other countries in the future.
I wrote in a piece not too long ago that it is basically disturbed and maybe rocked clearly faith in America as a leader, because if we don't keep treaties, who can trust us? I said that it's a little bit like buying a car from a carjacker now with respect to the United States. And as a result, even if we were to make another agreement, who would really trust us?
You know, it's interesting because the Trump administration has really put the Middle East very much at the center of its foreign policy agenda. As you step back from just Iran and you assess what's happening, what do you see?
I see the Middle East in turmoil, not the fault of the Trump administration, but it came over a period of time, the so-called Arab Spring. I see a horrendous civil war in Syria, with perhaps 500,000 people dead and 10 million forced as refugees. A similar civil war in Yemen, with serious starvation taking place, a genuine calamity. Real disruption in Libya. No progress on Israel and Palestine toward a solution that would be just and fair and equitable, and a situation in which Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states seemingly are pitting themselves for some kind of conflict against Iran, which makes no sense. The two of them are going to, in a sense, contest over leadership of the Middle East. The answer is neither one can win. Why do something that foolish? Why don't they sit down and talk about the question, can the Middle East be under a regime of balance between the players, mutual respect, a situation in which traditional cooperation, which used to exist between Shia and Sunni, between Arab and Persian, and certainly between Saudi Arabia and Iran, could be much more the order of the day, and have each one step by step test the other in a set of relationships that can build cooperation and trade and economic prosperity rather than the other way around. And of course, this is a diplomat's point of view, but it's certainly something we should work on and try before we end up aiding and abetting or supporting a war, and we would be drawn in inevitably to a conflict.
And why is that exactly? I mean, most of what you're describing, you talk about the civil war in Yemen, the civil war in Syria, you've got conflicts potentially between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Why does the U.S. have to be worried about getting drawn into that situation?
The president has gone to Saudi Arabia on a very early visit, danced the sword dance, promised to help them, be in effect a kind of silent but clear from the Saudi point of view, from the point of view of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, an ally in this. And we helped them, Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, in the war in Yemen, which they began as a way to deal with what they thought was a Shia danger from the Houthis. So we are involved already in many things, and it would be in our interest, clearly, not to continue the involvement to create more tension, conflict, and chances of accident, but to try to work with friends, allies, and partners to see if we can begin conversations first with the Saudis and the Iranians separately, but maybe getting them to the table.
I think it's safe to say that the U.S. has long had a close relationship with Saudi Arabia and with Israel, certainly during the administrations that you were a part of, that was the case. How are those relationships changing now? You've mentioned our closeness with each of those countries.
They were in many ways seen as being so far apart that they would never work together. that's been changing over the last 3 or 4 years. And so a number of circumstances have come up where it's clear. Certainly quietly between Saudi Arabia and Israel, conversations have taken place. The Prime Minister of Israel went to Oman on the southern end of the peninsula recently. It's become more overt. Israel has got more open relationships with some of the Gulf states. This is, in every respect, a good thing if it can first promote self-defense and secondly promote resolution diplomatically of the problems that are out there. And Israel has reason to be concerned by Iranian presence in Syria, has taken military action to fend that off. Israel has developed close relationships with President Putin. That's part of the mix.
So let me ask about sort of each of those countries where that relationship with between the Trump administration and a foreign government seems to have been very strong, at least between members of the Trump administration and individuals in those governments. In the case of Saudi Arabia, there's been a lot of concern about how that relationship is remaining close while even after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, even as Saudi Arabia is involved in the other civil wars in the region. Are you concerned that America is not separating itself further from the Saudi regime?
I am, and the American Congress certainly is. The Khashoggi murder and the Yemen civil war are clearly things the Congress takes seriously, and recent votes have demonstrated that. And there's a difference here, I think, with the administration on this issue, which hasn't been resolved. A number of Republicans in the Congress have objected to that. There's an opportunity, as there always is, I think, to see if the question can move. It's been very clear to many of us that King Salman of Saudi Arabia, the father of the crown prince, feels very strongly about Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem, and particularly Eastern Jerusalem, should continue to have its Arab character. And he, as a guardian of Islam, feels it's important to maintain that, as does Jordan, the neighbor, which has responsibilities in Jerusalem under the peace treaty to protect and guard Arab interests through an Arab charitable foundation.
Well, I mean, let's move over to Israel then. There's been news this week. One of the big events was the recognition of by the president in a tweet and then in an interview of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, land occupied previously belonging to Syria. The rest of the world still considers it to belong to Syria. What's your reaction to that?
Brian, I think it was obviously clearly designed to help Prime Minister Netanyahu in the coming election, where he is running strongly but not so clearly out in front, but where in the long run the decision will be made in the election by the kind of coalition he can form. But he's very much has his heart set on it. It gained us nothing because, in effect, it put us on the side of those people who believe taking territory by military force is okay. We just signed up for that deal. And, of course, that's something in the past that we have fought against, whether it was Hitler or Japan in the Second World War, whether it was Iraq and its invasion of Kuwait. All kinds of things are bedrock of American policy. And why should we turn that around? Now, does Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu have a role to play in the American elections? We'll wait and see. But there's no other ostensible reason for taking that step. And clearly, is it another step in the direction of the move of the embassy, the changing of the consulate general, the recognition of other factors in which the Trump administration says it wants to change the game on the ground, and it's doing that.
That this is the move of the American embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem,
that's right.
which is a major problem for the Palestinians. I guess my question is, after all of these critiques of American foreign policy under President Trump, what appears to you to be the underlying philosophy guiding our diplomatic efforts in the Middle East right now, or do you think there is one?
I think that your last sentence is probably closer to the reality than trying to confect a strategy. The strategy seems to be very close relations with Israel, perhaps efforts in one way or another to build that. That may be more closely connected to American domestic policy than necessarily it is to the future of peace in the Middle East. If that is indeed the case, we are now interrupting some of the elements. We are reducing our capacity to be influential with the other side of the peace arrangements, with the Arab world and the Palestinians. That doesn't augur well because it then allows the Russians or the Chinese or somebody else to assume this role. And if the Israelis believe that'll be a kinder, friendlier, gentler role, I think they want to go back and reexamine that assumption.
Well, you are a former ambassador to Israel. What would you be doing right now if you had the president's ear and were the ambassador? How would you be approaching Benjamin Netanyahu at this moment?
I would not be changing facts on the ground to try to change outcomes, but rather I would stay with the policies that have served us well. We will do nothing in Jerusalem that will prefigure the outcome of negotiations. We will support a negotiation on a two-state solution, that the border will be something like the 1967 ceasefire line, plus or minus additions and subtractions on an equal basis. We will try to treat the refugees who've occurred in that region fairly on both sides. We will work for a situation in which we can contribute and Israel can have security with respect to its future and its boundaries and its borders, and that the Palestinians can get the same sort of honorable treatment, and that this would open the door, I hope, to larger relations between Israel and the Arab states in the region, so it no longer lives as a kind of hermit surrounded by enemies as it sees them, and that I would work hard, particularly on the Iranian position in Syria, to make sure that that doesn't threaten the security of Israel or the region. And I would have kept the nuclear agreement as the basis for a relationship with Iran. Far from perfect. Iran is not an angel, but it's the basis for improving that relationship rather than destroying the agreement.
A lot of people think the two-state solution, that ship has sailed, that the moment has passed when that's still possible, whether it's because of the growth of the Israeli settlements or just the changing tenor of the conversation in the region. You don't think so?
It's a great question, and you have to look to solve that issue at the alternatives. One is that Israel expels all the Palestinians and occupies one state west of the Jordan River. The other is highly unlikely to happen, that the Arabs gather up their skirts and chase all the Jews out of Israel. Neither of those is really feasible, acceptable, ethical, moral, or reasonable. And so we're set that the alternative is to split the territory, which has been around since the independence of Israel in 1948.
Let's take a step back. When you look at the rest of American foreign policy, is there anything that you can point to and say the Trump administration has got this part right? This has been good progress in the last couple of years.
I thought that I would give them a very strong half a point on North Korea. I like the idea that they increased the pressure very strongly. I was afraid that that pressure might drive us into conflict, but that the South Korean President Moon Jae-in and his people helped to open the summit. I think we were terribly badly prepared for the summit. We bungled two summits very, very badly. The pressure has gone for naught. We now have to, in fact, wake up and begin to move step by step to dismantle the North Korean nuclear program and step by step unwind it.
You know, we're talking later in this hour with former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, and maybe that's why this is on my mind. Is America safer or less safe as a result of foreign policy decisions made in the past couple of years?
It's a great question, and I think that it is worth examining. And it's hard for me to say we're less safe, but the world is more chaos and more tumultuous. We have a bigger problem, and I'm sure Secretary Napolitano will talk about it, in defending the homeland and Americans overseas as a result of our loss of influence and our need to deploy Americans all around the world to help deal with terrorism that our allies should be helping us with. Mm-hmm. And certainly they're giving it a college try. But also the fact that we are much less influential with many states around the world, including our friends and allies allies in Europe means that the tatters of that relationship impinge on American security. So I would conclude that happily we have not had a major violent incident here. I wish I could tell you that that was an absolute certainty for the future, and I see a buildup against us still in the world of terrorism not yet taken care of.
That's U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering, has been ambassador to the United Nations and many countries, has served as an undersecretary of state, and is in town tonight to speak to the International Relations Council, which you can find out more about at irckc.org. Ambassador, thank you so much for spending time with us this
morning. Thank you, Brian. An honor and pleasure to be with you.
When we come back, we'll move from this former top diplomat to a former Homeland Security Secretary, from national security abroad to our safety here at home. Janet Napolitano talks about whether our country is as safe as it could be and as it should be. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, our political panel delved into Kansas and Missouri politics and the goings-on in the Kansas City mayoral election, which is next week. You can hear that show and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. And tomorrow, it's the best day of the year. We'll be live from opening day at the K to celebrate baseball season. We'll meet some behind-the-scenes staff who make a day at the ball field possible, and we'll talk about the rebuilding that the Royals are doing on the field as well. Join us tomorrow at 11. 3 years ago, the ultimately successful presidential campaign of Donald Trump promised, among other things, that he would make America safe again. Safety and security are among the fundamental responsibilities of government, a reality that came to the forefront after 9/11. But today, 18 years later, how safe are we? One of America's first responses to 9/11 was to create the Department of Homeland Security, and 10 years ago, Janet Napolitano became its third secretary. She's recently been writing and speaking about that experience and how well we as a nation are doing when it comes to our own safety. She joins us this morning from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Secretary Napolitano, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Brian.
It's good to have you. And, of course, Secretary Napolitano will be in Kansas City tomorrow at 7 p.m. for an author event at the Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can learn more at rainydaybooks.com. Secretary, your book is titled How Safe Are We? And so let me start there. How safe are we?
Well, I think in some areas, you know, we're very safe. In other areas, you know, risks continue to evolve, threats continue to evolve, and we're not as safe as we should be.
One of the areas where we hear a lot about safety and security these days is at the border with Mexico. And you, of course, were governor of Arizona before you became President Obama's Homeland Security Secretary. Is there a substantially greater threat at the southern border with Mexico today than there was when you took office?
No. And let me share with the listeners my perspective on the border. You know, I know that border so well. I've walked it. I've ridden it on horseback. I've flown over it by helicopter, by plane. The border is a zone. It is a zone through which a lot of legitimate traffic needs to occur, travel, trade, and the like. And it needs to have a strategy that's deployed there so that it is as secure as it can be without it being sealed like a Ziploc bag, which is a physical impossibility. And so what that requires is manpower and technology, things like ground sensors and tunnel detectors and air cover, and increasing use of technology and strengthening of our actual ports of entry. That's a strategy for the border. A wall is not a strategy, it's a symbol.
Yeah, you have feelings about the president's wall.
I do have feelings. When I was governor, I used to say, show me a 10-foot wall and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder.
Yeah.
You know, I think you have to think about who is actually coming into the United States illegally between our ports of entry. And the composition of that traffic has really changed. And now it's families with young children fleeing the circumstances in Central America. We have a process by which we handle those kinds of claims. It's called the asylum process. And I think what we ought to be doing as a country is, I call it flooding the zone with the rule of law, hiring more immigration judges, stationing them there at the southwest border so that families with children can have their claims adjudicated in accord with the rule of law, and the cases are processed.
And would the result of that, if somehow the process were able to be set up to adjudicate more of these cases more quickly, do you think we would see more of these, what are now undocumented immigrants, becoming legitimate recipients of asylum in this country? Or would we find that that amounted to good border security, keeping people out, as the current administration has said it wants to do?
Well, I think it'd be a little bit of both. I think under a fair reading of our asylum law that many of those petitioning for asylum would be entitled to asylum in our country, and they would be able to come in and be here in a legal status. Some won't be able to meet their burden of proof, and they'll be returned home. And that's the way the process is designed to work. It's just not working very well right now.
There obviously is a flow of undocumented immigrants coming in, some of whom would be asylum candidates and some would not. Clearly, there are drugs, although mostly those are smuggled through checkpoints, we know. You say this calls for a strategy, not a wall. With not wanting to oversimplify, what are the elements of that strategy that you would turn to first?
Well, I would turn to the elements of the strategy that, frankly, we were deploying during Obama's presidency that drove illegal immigration to 45-year lows. We added more Border Patrol agents. We added significantly to technology that could be used by the Border Patrol agents. We added air cover across the entire expanse of the southwest border. And we worked with Mexico in terms of the design and the engineering of our ports of entry, recognizing that Mexico has an interest here too, because the trade goes both ways. And so having ports that are 21st century ports that can inspect vehicles for suspicious compartments but move the traffic through in a timely fashion, that's in both countries' interests.
If you have questions about Homeland Security in the present or maybe in the recent past, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's the number to talk with former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. 816-235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR up to date. One of the things you write about in the book, How Safe Are We, is the political blind spots that you say exist when it comes to protecting the nation's safety right now. What are some of those blind spots?
Well, I think one is the topic we were just discussing, which is the southwest border. The plain fact of the matter is that I would not place the southwest border on my top list of safety risks affecting the American people.
But it's the one we're talking about the most.
It is the one we're talking about the most. It's a huge distraction. It's a distraction for the media. It's a distraction for our population. It's a distraction for the Department of Homeland Security. Yes, we need a secure border, but a secure border does not mean a sealed border. We need to recognize that the border is a zone, and that there are lots of communities along that border. There are cities along that border. There are sovereign Indian nations along that border. And we need to take all of that into account. I would put as the more serious risks that we need to confront the risks associated with global warming and climate change, the risks associated with cybersecurity, the risks associated with mass gun violence and those who perpetrate that. I would put those as my top three.
Well, let's take each of those in turn, and let's start with climate change. A lot of people don't think of that as a security issue per se. They may agree that it's important. Why is the nation's safety at risk when it comes to global temperatures rising?
Well, let's unpack that a minute. So we see the increase in extreme weather events, landfall hurricanes, greater number and intensity of tornadoes, wildfires. Frankly, there have been more Americans killed in those extreme weather events over the past years than have been killed by any kind of terrorist activity. Mm-hmm. But then when you back up and you think about the condition of the planet, global warming affects migration patterns, and we're seeing a great global migration from south to north. It affects areas of the world that are experiencing extreme drought. The drought has killed agriculture, small farms, small markets, small communities, leaving legions of young men jobless and hopeless, ripe for terrorist recruitment. So climate has lots of impacts from a security and safety standpoint.
You mentioned also cybersecurity. We obviously have heard a little bit about efforts to affect the 2016 presidential election, but it goes beyond that for you, right?
It does. You know, we live in a networked world, and we are already experiencing lots of attacks and hacks on our critical infrastructure, on our personal information, our personal data. You know, after the 9/11 attacks, the country assembled a commission of leaders. It was nonpartisan, and it was designed to go back and see what led to the 9/11 attacks. And they pointed out to all the red flags that had been raised, but they also pointed out that there was a failure of imagination, you know, a failure to imagine that individuals coming here, going to flight school, would get on airplanes, weaponize them, and fly them into iconic buildings like the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. We have lots of red flags now in the cyber world, and I think we shouldn't wait for a 9/11-style cyber attack. We should be bringing together, perhaps with a commission of some sort, to really deal with the whole complex array of questions that arise in this cyber era.
You know, just the number of topics we've talked about so far, and we've only really scratched the surface here, speaks to some degree of the complexity of something like Homeland Security, and also the complexity of the department itself. A lot of people have asked ever since it was founded if the Department of Homeland Security is simply too bureaucratic, if there's too much going on for an operation to be coherent and effective. What's your take on that?
So that was a real challenge to me as secretary. The department is comprised of 22 formerly different agencies, different legacy departments, and there were some new agencies created, the TSA, for example, out of whole cloth. And so one of the things we really focused on was developing a common mission for the department and a real set of priorities for what we as a department were going to focus on. And, you know, over time, you begin to see the department coalescing and becoming a unified whole. Is it there yet? No. But by comparison, after World War II, when the Department of Defense was created, and that really only unified two or three major military departments, it took 40 or 50 years for the Department of Defense to be viewed as a coalesced whole. So I think the Department of Homeland Security is on its way, but it's not there yet.
If you have a question about the Department of Homeland Security or any of its functions, from airline security to domestic terrorism to emergency response, give us a call at 816-235-2888, and you can talk with former Secretary Janet Napolitano. Let's talk with Carlene in Lawrence. Carlene, thanks for calling Up to Date.
Thank you. Thanks for answering the phone here. I just wanted to thank the past Secretary of Homeland Security about your phrase in regards to the need for the U.S. government to work, and all other entities, to work closely with Mexico in regards to the transition of persons needing to come over the border. There's a phrase that I remember learning in college that the U.S. in the 70s and 80s see anywhere south of the U.S. as being their backyard, and they can throw whatever trash they want to do and do whatever back there. But I think we need to start thinking of anything south of the U.S. as being our true neighbors, and true neighbors, you take care of them. You work together so that they see you as a team player and not just the person collecting your trash.
I appreciate your call, Carlene. Let me ask the secretary, do you think that's an apt metaphor for how the U.S. Has or does see the relationship with Mexico? Is it our backyard rather than our neighbor?
No, I think a former governor of Arizona coined a phrase which I think is very apt, which is, he said, you know, God made the United States and Mexico neighbors. We should endeavor to be good neighbors. And I think that's the way we ought to approach Mexico. It's our ally. You know, when I was Secretary of Homeland Security, we worked very closely with Mexican law enforcement, with the Mexican Ministry of Justice. We worked on drug cartel cases. We worked on gun smuggling cases. We worked on lots of initiatives designed to keep the border zone as safe and secure as possible.
You know, your criticism of the current administration has been pretty unsparing. You said in the book, nearly 20 years after 9/11, we are witnessing Homeland Security malpractice, an administration that aggressively refuses to recognize threats that are real and certain, coupled with an equally aggressive effort to divert public attention and government resources toward issues that are less lethal but more potent politically. I'm struck that that's very similar to the criticism leveled in the first half of our program this morning by former Ambassador Thomas Pickering when it comes to foreign policy. I want to ask you the same question I asked him. What can be done? What, at this point, if you had the president's ear, if you found yourself suddenly as the Secretary of Homeland Security again, what would you do differently? Can it be turned around?
Oh, absolutely. And I thought Ambassador Pickering's comments were really spot on. Would I be the secretary now? I would say, you know, Mr. President, we need to focus on these large developing risks to the safety and security of the American people. We need your leadership in the area of climate change. We need to reengage with the Paris Accords. We need to focus communities on adaptation to the climate change that's already occurred. We need your leadership in bringing together the leading lights of the public and private sectors to work together on cybersecurity. And we need to devote our considerable public health and research expertise to really dwell down into the causes of mass gun violence and what can be done to prevent it.
Is there a way that that you would say the current president could walk back the positions that he has taken with regard to border security and with regard to the wall? Is there a way forward that allows him to maintain the political position he's taken while doing things that, in your view, would be better for America's homeland security?
Well, you know, I that's hard to say because so much of the president's politics are wrapped up in the wall. And as I said earlier, the wall's a symbol. It's not a strategy. And it doesn't reflect our real relationship with Mexico. You know, one thing the president could do is he could say, he could say, we're going to put the wall on hold and we're going to focus our resources on where the sources of this illegal migration is coming from. And it's coming from the violent circumstances that exist in Central America, the horrendous gang violence, the high homicide rates, etc. We did something very similar with Colombia. Colombia was a narco state. And we put together a plan working with Colombians who didn't want to live in a narco state and really turned the country around. Now it's almost a tourist destination. Mm. We need to do the same with Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, the source of this migration, because frankly, people don't want to leave their homes and make a very dangerous journey to come to a country and then try to get in the country and try to start a new living, et cetera, at a very difficult set of circumstances. And a little prevention would be worth a pound of cure here.
Well, speaking of prevention, another area of Homeland Security that is important to a lot of listeners in our area is the question of agro-terrorism. This is something that was lifted up certainly after 9/11 and frequently by Kansas Senator Pat Roberts in the years since. Where do you think we stand? You talk in your book about giving an American report card. What's the grade you would give our attention to the question of possible terrorism affecting the nation's agricultural industry?
Well, I definitely think this is something that deserves our attention. And one of the things I worked on with Senator Roberts was funding for the NBAF, which is a high-level agriculture, bio-agriculture facility to be located in Kansas. It illustrates all the different ways that somebody really intending to do the country harm could do the country serious harm. So we need to be putting some resources there as well.
Another you mentioned, but we didn't follow up with early in the program, was the threat caused by gun violence, which a lot of folks, again, don't think of as a Homeland Security issue per se, given that it is often the conversation is tied up in questions about constitutional rights and so on.
So, here it's very interesting. So if we have an incident of mass gun violence and it turns out the perpetrator is motivated by Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of those kind of ideologies, that goes clearly into the terrorism bucket, and you have the full resources of the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security. Everybody focuses on that. If it's motivated by something else, say white nationalism, right-wing extremism, or just pathology, that usually gets dealt with a bit differently. It gets dealt with by state and local law enforcement, with the feds providing backup. Either way, people end up dead. And one of the issues I think that we need to really bring out into the open in our country is the rise of white nationalism, right-wing extremism. We saw it in Charlottesville. We've seen it in several of the other shooting incidents since Charlottesville. This is something, I don't know whether it's increased or whether it's simply more public, but it definitely merits our attention.
There was a time in this country's history when we engaged in an arms race with other countries in order to stay secure. Is there a comparable event going on right now? Is it a tech race that we are in against other countries, that if we are going to stay secure, we're going to have to stay ahead?
I wouldn't put it in that way. I will say that our homeland security depends a lot on international security and efforts abroad. If we wait till a problem actually reaches our border, we've waited too long. That's what happened with the underwear bomber on Christmas Day of 2009. I talk about this in my book, where Abdul Muttalib was able to board a plane in Lagos, fly to Amsterdam, get on a plane from Amsterdam to Detroit, and he had explosives in his underwear, and he had acid with him to activate the explosives, and he did that. He was trying to blow up a plane when it reached U.S. airspace. And we had red flags about Abdul Muttalib before he boarded that flight. But by policy and practice, he was not going to be inspected till he actually landed in the United States. Well, that's crazy. And we had to reverse engineer how we deal with information about international air travelers coming to the United States, and tighten up how we do the security at those last points of departure. So Homeland Security really depends on international efforts as well.
Well, speaking of security of flights, I will say that when folks heard I was talking with you today, someone said, ask her why we still have to take our shoes off at the airport. In this day and age, why is that? Is that a reflection of failure on the part of our Homeland Security work?
I think it's a reflection of threat streams. So when I was secretary, and I think it's probably still true today, there was a constant series of threat streams involving people trying to get explosives into airplanes, maybe because they see 9/11 as kind of the gold standard of a terrorist attack. I don't know. And the technology simply isn't there to be able to easily look at a person's shoes when a person is in the shoes, or evaluate liquids. And, you know, I think if we'd been able to figure that out before we left as before I left as secretary, maybe I'd be running for president now. Who knows? But so what we did, while hopefully the technology does develop, is we instituted TSA PreCheck, which is a way to identify passengers who are known passengers that are no risk, that we can put into another line, and they don't have to have they can leave their shoes on and so forth. And I think TSA PreCheck has been very popular, and deservedly so.
I certainly appreciate it. So I guess a question I have, as I hear you answer that, and as you allude to being president, is about your life in public service and maybe even your future. You wrote that it's important to recognize that even good people will disappoint their friend and make bad decisions from time to time. Public service does not need to be a blood sport. You were a governor, you were a cabinet member, you're now the president of the University of California system. What are you seeing in today's public servants, and would you ever want to be one of them again?
Well, I think technically I still am a public servant.
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
In an elected
I run a public
or a
university.
Sure.
What I see, unfortunately, is a hardening of partisan lines and people retreating to their corner of the ring. And, we are a country with a lot of diversity and diversity of political views. And there's a lot of talking out there, but not a lot of listening. I'd like to see some more listening.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to listen to you for a few minutes this morning. That's former U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
She is the author with Karen Breslow of How Safe Are We? She's also speaking tomorrow night at Unity Temple on the Plaza, and you can find out more at the Rainy Day Books website. Yesterday on the program, we dissected the phrase religious liberty, and we heard how the concept has evolved in our country. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Also, we hope you'll find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook and Instagram as well. Tomorrow, bring your ponchos and join us for a live broadcast from opening day at Kauffman Stadium. We'll talk baseball, and we'll meet some of the folks whose daily work makes every day at the K fun for Royals fans. Join us then. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.